This is Cool Science Radio, Science and Technology. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. John Wells is out today. My guest, Mark Honigsbaum, is a medical historian, journalist, and the author of five books, including the recent book we'll discuss today, The Pandemic Century, 100 Years of Panic, Hysteria, and Hubris. It surveys the last century of scientific struggle against an enduring enemy, deadly contagious disease. Ever since the 1918 Spanish influenza pandemic, scientists have dreamed of preventing catastrophic outbreaks of infectious disease. Yet despite a century of medical progress, viral and bacterial disasters continue to take us by surprise, inciting panic and dominating news cycles. Honigsbaum joins me by phone from the UK to share his well-researched stories from the Spanish flu through the more recent SARS, Ebola, and Zika epidemics. Mark, welcome to Cool Science Radio. Great to have you.
Thank you for inviting me. It's great to be on.
Well, we could have gone back. You could have gone back as far as, say, the 1300s, the Black Plague. But you're concentrating on this most recent century, and I'm wondering if that's because you're quite fascinated that we haven't tackled infectious disease with all the medical advancement that we have tackled.
Yes, it's partly that, but it's mainly because it's only since the advent of bacteriology and rational scientific medicine from the end of the 19th century onwards that scientists have been in a position of being equipped to actually understand, the pathogenesis of infectious diseases and devise rational therapies and vaccines against them. So I concentrate very much on that period. It's also a period I've studied deeply as an academic. So that's kind of my prejudice. But it's also to do with the fact that we're still very much living in the virological century that began with the Spanish influenza pandemic in 1918. Not many people realize this, but descendants of that Spanish flu virus, which was an H1N1, continue to circulate to this day.
Wow. Mm. So tell me, when does an outbreak become an epidemic? When does an epidemic become pandemic?
That is a very, very, very good question. So it's not that easy to actually define the difference between an epidemic and a pandemic. So I suppose you can think of an outbreak as a confined emergence. So usually when we talk about epidemics or pandemics, we're referring to new diseases to medical science. Okay, that's not always the case, but generally speaking, we're talking about an outbreak of a disease that hasn't hitherto been recognized. So when an outbreak becomes big enough people are affected, then we would classify it as an epidemic. And when it spreads to several countries or more usually regions and continents at the same time, then it's a pandemic.
Okay. So since you mentioned the Spanish influenza, let's go there. So one of the mistakes made, if I understand correctly, was that it was identified as bacteria and not as a virus. And how does that happen?
Well, so this is one of the main themes of my book. So what I'm interested in is both how medical scientists repeatedly forget the sort of lessons of past epidemics and pandemics, but also how they can be blinded or not get the whole picture because of the sort of technologies, laboratory tools that are available to them at the time. So the Spanish flu is a very good example of that because several years before the 1918 pandemic, a German bacteriologist who worked closely with Robert Koch had declared that he had isolated the pathogen of influenza, and it was a bacillus. So it was true that in cases of influenza, you can isolate all sorts of bacteria that reside in the nose, throat, and sputum of influenza sufferers. And one of these bacilli he called bacilli influenza, and that was the dominant paradigm up until and continue even after the 1918 flu. That was the received wisdom. Of course, there were scientists who weren't able to cultivate this bacteria consistently in cases of flu. Sometimes they did, sometimes they didn't. Sometimes they found it in people who didn't have flu at all, because we now know that this bacillus, known as Haemophilus influenzae, commonly lives in the nose and throat of all of us without always causing disease. The reason why people couldn't understand it was a virus at this point was because they didn't have powerful enough microscopes. But more importantly, they hadn't yet found an animal model in which they could passage the virus repeatedly. So these two elements meant that they just couldn't see what subsequently became known.
And so not seeing that, not knowing what it was sort of allowed the passage, the transmission of the influenza throughout the world. I believe a lot of soldiers were going off to the end of World War I at that point and spreading it throughout Europe. And then,
well, I mean, it was a combination of that, but also your listeners will be familiar with this themselves. If you just think of one's general experience of influenza, we don't generally think of influenza as a plague-like infection, do we? It's something that comes around every year around winter. You know, it can cause debilitating illness, but more generally, you'll be ill for a few days. You might have to take off work for a bit, but then you'll recover. So it's not considered a particularly serious disease most of the time. And this was certainly the prejudice that most physicians had at the time of the 1918 flu. There had been a previous pandemic, but it was all the way back in 1889, 1890. So then, unless you'd had experience of that pandemic, you didn't really think of flu as a particular danger. And at the outbreak of war, physicians in the U.S. Army and military physicians in other parts of the world were much more concentrated on other diseases that they knew were a problem in times of warfare. They didn't think flu was going to be one of those problematic diseases. So it was a combination of not really understanding the viral ecology, but also the way that the disease was thought of as generally, you know, not a serious cause of illness, certainly not something that would kill large numbers of young men who were being primed for war.
Right. If you're just joining us, my guest is Mark Honigsbaum. He's the author of The Pandemic Century, 100 Years of Panic, Hysteria, and Hubris. And I suppose it's a great tagline. Hubris, for example, you begin with your book with a prologue that's very interesting, the metaphor between the predator of a shark as a shark and also infectious disease. Why do you use that example? And can you take us through it a bit?
Yes, no, of course. I mean, it's not the most obvious example. But so when I was thinking about the pandemic century, I have to tell you that my wife is American and her family is from New York, but her father has a beach house in New Jersey on the Jersey Shore.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that's a very famous part of the world because in 1916, there were a series of shark attacks on the Jersey Shore in which several people died. What was significant about them is that, so these were shark attacks that inspired the film Jaws, right, which everybody knows. And we now know better than to swim too far out beyond the lifelines in case there might be sharks patrolling that bit of the coast. But in 1916, people didn't know that. On the contrary, experts in shark behavior and other fish behavior said that because there had never been a shark attack in the cool waters of the North Atlantic, it was an impossibility. They said there was no risk of people being attacked by sharks, simply because they'd never seen it before, never experienced it before. It was an unknown, okay? So I thought that was a very good metaphor because the epidemics I canvass in the book also can be seen as things that were impossible, couldn't happen until they did happen, and then that overturned the conventional wisdom. So why hubris? Because experts have to be very careful about making these all-encompassing statements and judgments, because the history of epidemics and pandemics has shown repeatedly that the received wisdom has been flawed or wrong. They haven't had the whole picture.
Yeah. I just have to ask you briefly about measles, and measles at this point is an outbreak with some 700 cases in the U.S. And just in the news this morning, this talk of a cruise ship being quarantined because of an outbreak of measles. And I'm wondering about the evolution of infectious disease. I mean, we thought we put measles to rest with the vaccination. I suppose we never, and it's the same sort of with polio, that we've put it to rest with vaccinations. But I read in your book that also, you know, disease can lie dormant in our own tissues for decades. And so what is going on there? Is there really a life cycle of disease, or does it just go away for a while with vaccination or without, or not? I'm curious about that.
You're asking lots of kind of separate but interlinked questions there. If I could destructure a little bit. So yes, I mean, you know, if you have been exposed to measles or any other, or influenza is a good example, right? We're all exposed to influenza usually before the age of two. That exposure to influenza will give us an enduring immunity to most other influenzas we'll encounter in life. But as we age, as we get older, our immune systems don't work as well, essentially. So therefore, an influenza that may not have caused severe illness to us when we're young and healthy may actually cause more severe illness later. Or, you know, you can have disease, shingles, for instance, you know, the herpes virus, chickenpox. You have immunity to chickenpox once you've had chickenpox, but it still lies dormant in the body. So if you suffer some other disease that causes your immune system to be compromised in some way, you could break out in shingles. So there are all sorts of diseases that, even though we have immunity, that immunity isn't necessarily 100% awful all of our lives, okay? The point about vaccines, going to vaccines, is that I think it's very interesting, the point you raise about these measles outbreaks. So when I was writing this book, I thought, well, you know, I finished the book in around 2018. I thought, in the way one does, when the book comes out, it wouldn't be a bad thing necessarily if there was an epidemic of some kind. It might generate an interest in the subject matter. But I never dreamed it would be an epidemic of a vaccine-preventable disease. We should not be having these outbreaks of measles, because we have a very effective vaccine that's proven to give something like, you know, no immunity from a vaccine is 100%. But it's nearly as good as the natural immunity you would get if you had measles as a child. So it's a mystery why people are seemingly rejecting vaccines and exposing not just their own children, but others, people's children, to the risk of measles, which is a very, very serious disease. Right? It can cause encephalitis, brain damage. You can be rendered deaf or blind. I suppose what I'm saying is that I kind of had to check my own hubris partly here, because I never dreamt that we'd be seeing outbreaks of something that vaccines have prevented. I foresaw all sorts of different epidemics, but not that one.
Hmm. Yeah, very interesting. And I suppose it's the same. Well, I was trying to think of an example where a vaccine has completely eradicated a disease, like smallpox, I believe. The only existence of smallpox is somewhere in a test tube.
Correct.
And yet, so with measles, for example, even if we were vaccinated, our immunity can wane over time. Like now, I think we're being asked to maybe go get a booster shot for measles. So our immunity wanes. And so what does that say about the ability of an infectious disease to just crop up again?
Well, I mean, this is the point. This is why the eradication of smallpox was such a huge achievement, because the only way you can be sure that the disease will not come back is to completely eradicate it from its human host, but also if it resides in animal population. I mean, you can't, you know, the thing about smallpox is it only at the time we eliminated it, it only resided in human populations. So once it disappeared from human populations, there was no possibility of it coming back unless it was an accidental or deliberate terrorist release from a laboratory. And the same is true of measles. Measles has been around since the beginning of civilization. It's been around so long, we don't know what animal host it originated in. It's only circulated, as far as we know, in human populations. So it would be a huge achievement to eradicate it. But that's obviously a long way off now. But it's not with the case of polio. I mean, polio, we're very close to getting rid of the disease. But it continues to flare up because of conflicts in parts of the world where, you know, which impede vaccination campaigns in some way, or in areas of the world where people distrust and lose confidence in the vaccine. But yes, I mean, eradication is the goal, and it's only been attained once with smallpox.
Right. There's a lot of panic around Ebola, and I think of the first time there was an outbreak of Ebola, it being so incredibly severe, killing people so quickly, and I remember it in the early 90s, I believe. Then it seemed to subside for a while, and now it's back. But it's my understanding that people are quite a bit in denial about it on the African continent.
So this is interesting. In a way, it's really no different from the sort of denial that you, in America and Europe and elsewhere, with regard to measles and vaccinations. So there are people who don't think of measles as a serious disease and don't see why they should be required by the health authorities to vaccinate their children if they want to go to school. It's really no different in Africa, even though we here are aware of how serious Ebola is. In Africa, there are lots of other things that might kill you, to be blunt, right? It could be a roving militia. Or it could be something like malaria or a diarrheal disease, which are much more present risks in people's lives. So Ebola feels to people in those areas presumably like a more remote risk. They question whether it's even a real disease, because what they see from their perspective is, you know, they're ignored for large, for many years by sort of Western health responders or aid teams. Suddenly there's an Ebola outbreak, and they see floods of foreigners arriving in their country with equipment. So what happens is conspiracy theories circulate that the government has just invented this disease as a way of attracting foreign aid and humanitarian funds to the country. So there's a lot of distrust all over the world in medical technologies, I'm afraid.
And also the mutation of microbes, or the mutation of a disease itself, also keeps us keeps scientists guessing, because you can't really predict. I mean, can you take the lessons from the past and apply those to the future and have any better outcomes with tracking how an infectious disease and the microbes associated with it will mutate?
Well, I mean, so this is a very good question. So we know that microbes continue mutating. The best example of that, again, is influenza. Influenza is continually circulating globally. And, you know, there are strains that circulate in humans, but also strains that circulate in pigs and swine. And then there are all these wild strains, these wild avian strains that circulate in geese and ducks and other migratory birds. And at any point, you know, an individual strain might mutate, or it might combine with another wild strain to create a new potentially pandemic strain. So, and we have got a lot better at monitoring and surveilling those things. So, you know, medical science has got better at joining up the different professions. So, you know, public health microbiologists now coordinate with veterinary ecologists who might actually go in and take blood samples in live animal markets in China and elsewhere, specifically looking for, you know, the next strain of bird flu or, you know, the next coronavirus that might spark another SARS epidemic. And again, we do a similar thing in Sierra Leone, West Africa, Central Africa, looking for the reservoir, the animal reservoir of Ebola that's presumed to reside in bats, that might get into monkey populations. So, yes, we can take blood and serum and study it and look for the next emerging virus. But often the simplest precautions are the tried and tested lessons from previous pandemics, that often what causes the outbreak isn't because the virus has suddenly changed in some way, but that human behavior has changed the way that the virus can get out and spread to more people, if you see what I mean.
So yeah,
that could be because we suddenly build roads to a part, a forested region that was previously inaccessible, or it could be because of global warming and climate change, putting pressure on remote habitats, so you get human habitations, people going in to collect timber from the rainforest, and therefore coming into contact with animals that might harbor viruses that they wouldn't ordinarily encounter.
I wasn't going to ask about the Zika virus, but since, I mean, it's a big part of your book, of course, but we know quite a lot about it. And since you mentioned climate change, it made me think about the Zika virus. It seems that every sort of winter, at least in North America, we stop hearing about Zika virus. And then as soon as the summer hits, that's when we start worrying about it in areas like, you know, Florida and South Texas and places like that. But what is the current state of Zika?
Well, I mean, Zika hasn't gone away. I mean, the reason you're not reading or hearing about Zika very much now is because the reason it became visible is that populations in Brazil and other parts of South America until 2015 hadn't been exposed to the Zika virus before, so therefore nobody had immunity. So this is typical when a virus first encounters the human host who hasn't encountered it before, they'll have no protection. So that's when you see a lot of people getting ill and, you know, expressing very severe symptoms. Now that a large number of people have been effectively immunized by their previous exposure to Zika, they have antibodies against it. So it could still be circulating, but it won't be causing widespread illness and infections, and you won't be seeing these signals, presumably, of women giving birth to babies with these very disturbing congenital deformities, you know, microcephaly. But epidemiologists presume that in, I don't know how many years exactly, but when enough new people are born who haven't been exposed to Zika, then there'll be a large enough population to cause another outbreak and maybe an epidemic.
Okay, that's a really interesting explanation. It makes a lot of sense. There are so many epidemics, pandemics that you include in your book that I won't have time to ask you about, but things I've never heard of, the great parrot fever pandemic and the Philly killer. Such an interesting
talk about
book.
The plague one, shouldn't we? Because I notice in Utah you have prairie dogs, which harbor the plague bacillus.
Well, we ought to, yes, prairie dogs. Tell us about that.
Well, I mean, as you'll be aware, since you live in Utah, I mean, from time to time, hikers encounter prairie dogs or maybe a squirrel, and if they're exposed to a flea bite from one of those animals, those fleas might harbor exactly the same plague bacillus that was the cause of, you know, the bubonic plague outbreak in San Francisco at the turn of the 20th century, you know, the great San Francisco plague epidemic. But the one I feature in my book is a less-known outbreak that occurred in Los Angeles in 1924. The reason this was interesting is that although it started as an outbreak of bubonic plague, it actually turned into a pneumonic variety of the plague, which is the fastest-moving, most deadly form of plague of all. And it very much fits with the theme of my book, because at the time, you know, bacteriologists had studied plague extensively, right? They had all the experience of the San Francisco outbreak. They knew that rats and that fleas from rats were transmitted. It could transmit it to humans, so that if you cleaned up, got rid of rats, under dwellings and remove them from port areas, you've effectively contained and controlled the disease. Nobody thought that it was possible to have pneumonic plague in California, certainly in Southern California, because it was too hot, right? There'd been pneumonic plague outbreaks in Manchuria, in Southern China, but that was because it was thought you had cold, it was cold in those places. There was more water in the atmosphere, and you needed water droplets for the respiratory to transmit the respiratory disease over large distances and infect large numbers of people. So people actually said, it's impossible we're going to have a pneumonic plague outbreak in Los Angeles. You might get it in those cities in the east, they said, right, New York or Boston. And this was almost seen as a reason to come to Los Angeles, you know, escape all those horrible unsanitary diseases you get in the east or the middle of America, come to this sunny, hygienic climate. So it was very embarrassing to, business leaders and people who ran the Chambers of Commerce in Los Angeles in 1924 when suddenly a disease from the Middle Ages, the Dark Ages, arrives in the city of tomorrow, the city of angels.
Wow, that is fascinating. Mm. Well, watch out for those prairie dogs and squirrels. I've got them all over my yard.
And squirrels, yeah.
Yes. Well, the book is The Pandemic Century, 100 Years of Panic, Hysteria, and Hubris. My guest is Mark Honigsbaum, a medical historian and journalist. Thanks so much, Mark. Really interesting book.
Yeah, lovely to talk to you. Thank you for having me.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.